You are listening to the Political Periscope, a weekly podcast brought to you by Radio WNET. Interviews on international politics, security, geopolitics, economy, and more, every Thursday at 7 p.m.
Today's guest of the Political Periscope is Christian Power, Central and Eastern Europe reporter for the Dutch public broadcaster NOS.
Political Periscope.
You've been recently to Ukraine, to the territories that were affected by the flood after the blowing up of the dam. How was it?
Well, obviously, from the start, it was clear that it was going to be a catastrophe, what's happening around the Dnieper River right now and over the last weeks. But still, you can't really imagine the skill up to the point that you get there, especially in the beginning. There was not that much reporting from the ground. There were, of course, videos coming out. It took us a couple of days to get to the actual affected area. And interestingly, we first went to Kherson, and when you arrive, you notice a rather calm environment where people living in the city basically walk around in their shorts and slippers. And the moment you proceed, at some point, it's just the street ends in water, basically, and you realize that half of the city is flooded. Now, we were there for the humanitarian story, first of all. When we arrived, it was a rather calm environment, and you nearly forget that it's actually a city on the front line, and you nearly forget how quickly it can escalate, the situation can escalate. And that's also what happened when we were there, when we were reporting on the volunteers helping people out of their houses and Russians started bombarding the city. So yeah, that's the moment you realize that it's not only an ecological disaster and a humanitarian disaster, but also still a war zone, a very intense war zone where inhabitants have been living under shelling for months now, heavy Russian shelling.
What was maybe some image, maybe some scene, what was the thing that impressed you the most in negative or positive way?
Well, it was the surprise, but not entirely surprising, what we already seen in Ukraine over the last year, how quickly the whole help and support for in these kind of situations, whether it's bombings or in this case, this blowing up of the dam, how quickly the help was set up and underway and how people just got to work, right? It's what we see all through Ukraine during this war. At the same time, it becomes clear how the scale of the catastrophe becomes very clear quickly. I drove around the town with a volunteer who was helping people out of their houses. We went around in his little dinghy. All of a sudden, you realize you're not going around the Dnieper, but you're going around town. But you're in a boat, right? And you see gas stations, you know, entirely underwater. At some point, I realized I had to cover my head. I had to make sure I was low enough to not bump my head into some electrical cables, which turned out to be the cables of the tram that would run over the street we were crossing, but then by boat. And that's when you see the scale of the catastrophe. And at the same time, there were some people in the city who decided to just wait it out, who were like, well, you know, we survived Russian occupation. We've survived months and months of heavy shelling. We're just going to wait it out and hope that the water goes away soon so we can, you know, just try to get back on our feet.
Is there maybe a need, an urge, a temptation when you're there as a journalist, when you see people suffering, to just drop the microphone, drop the camera and start helping?
Interesting question. It's obviously an old, a very known question and difficulty for journalists. When do you start helping, right? I guess in my situation at that point, I knew that my role was there to be a journalist, to report on what's happening there, to report on the catastrophe and on the shelling and what happened to the volunteers. When we were there, people also died, and people have been dying during these rescue operations. So that's my role. If I would end up in some kind of situation where a person is in urgent need at that very spot, I mean, I guess then things change. I haven't been in that specific situation yet. But yeah, that would change the situation. But you clearly have to distinguish what your role is in such an area.
From Kherson, you went to the front line.
Well, yeah. So basically, we were there when also the Ukrainian counteroffensive was starting to pick up speed, right? And the big question was, what's actually happening there? We had certain limitations. We decided not to go all the way into the trenches. For that, we didn't have the proper tools, the proper maybe also support to make that happen. We were close, up to 10, 15 kilometers from the front line, to see what was, you know, what we could see there, what kind of movements, what the general vibe was of the soldiers there. Obviously, the image we are shown, and which is definitely correct, is a very resilient Ukraine over the last year. Resilient in the fact that they are very much convinced that they're going to take back all the country, all the land taken by Russia over the last year, and basically since 2014, right? But there's also realism if you speak to the actual soldiers who know the reality of such a like incredible, like it's impossible to imagine what kind of situation these men are in. It's like classic trench warfare, right? So, and they see that as well. I spoke to drone operators who basically go as close as they can to do reconnaissance missions and map out the Russian trenches, right, which is crucial if you want to force your way through at some point. And they also express, like, yeah, of course, I mean, we're going to take it back, but it's not going to be easy. So that's very much clear that maybe we expect, also with all the fuss and all the hype about a counteroffensive, that we expect some quick results, but that's not the case, right? It can take months or longer before Ukraine might actually be able to go through these lines. And it's far from decided, of course.
You are reporting all this for the Netherlands, for people in Netherlands. What is the reaction of public in the Netherlands? What is the attitude? Do people still care about Ukraine, about war in Ukraine?
I think so, very much so, actually. There are no signs that people in the Netherlands are hesitant about their support of anything. Most recent polling at the end of last year suggested that actually the Netherlands is, together with Poland, one of the most supportive countries, if we're talking about public opinion, right? Supporting Ukraine to take back all its territory before even considering any kind of deal with Russia. And yeah, no, so in general, the public has been very supportive, and that's also has also strengthened our politicians to become the forefront of support for Ukraine. For example, if we talk about, if we have the debate about F-16s, the Netherlands has been now for some time saying, has been saying that Ukraine has to have F-16s to fight Russia, and the Netherlands is willing to give that kind of training because we have F-16s ourselves as well.
I think that the shutting down of MH17 flight really affected the public opinion in the Netherlands.
It was definitely an important ingredient for us, for our understanding of this conflict. And I guess also for us to be taken out of our a bit naive approach to Russia over the last decades, right? We've always been a merchant country. That's where our strength came from. We traded with Russia a lot. We always figured, a bit like Germany, of course, as well, that as long as we continued our close economic ties with Russia, there would be no rationale and there would be no reason for Moscow to start some kind of broader conflict. Even though the signs were clearly there over the years, we didn't really want to believe that. MH17 clearly opened our eyes, especially the response, not just the tragedy itself, right, and the shooting down of this airline itself, but the reaction from Russia, you know, the constant denial, the refusal to actually productively cooperate with an international investigation, denying. It showed us the cynicism from the Russian side for this tragedy, and it made us, so it opened our eyes, definitely. But there are plenty of other reasons, I'd say, as well, why the Netherlands has been so supportive. It's probably, our Prime Minister recently wrote that as well, pointed that out, the element of a smaller nation being invaded by its big neighbor, right? And obviously something we lived through in the Second World War. Big, what we thought was a brotherly nation invaded us, and it's some kind of, there's some kind of historical parallel that might inspire people in the Netherlands as well. And also, I do feel like, I mean, the interesting part, what we've seen all through Europe, is that the whole reason why, obviously, Putin said this war was necessary, because the NATO threats and all, you know, the supposed arguments why this is a special military operation to defend Russia, whatever Russia did only strengthened the understanding in also in countries like the Netherlands, with all the horrific images coming out of Ukraine, it strengthened the understanding and belief in the Netherlands as well, that for years we've been indulging Russia, right? We've been trying to keep them friends. We, in 2013, we even had a friendly Russia-Netherlands year. which I was actually part of as well. I worked as an intern back then, all with a bigger plan of close economic ties in the end will also bring a more democratic and liberal Russia. And that's something we have to reconcile with right now as well, because we've basically been supporting these a Russian war chest, which is now responsible for a large-scale, full-scale invasion with tens of thousands of deaths as a cause of it, as a result.
Before the Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2022, Poland had some conflicts with the European Commission. We have our reasons, but I know that the public opinion in the West was rather not very friendly towards Poland in this case. Did the situation change, and how it changed in Netherlands, that this image of Poland after the Russian invasion?
Yeah, it's a very interesting point. And I think it's a rather critical debate that has not, about which the harsh, we're sort of circling around it right now, and the harsh words have not been said yet. Basically, what you've noticed with the full-scale invasion, that Poland realized that it had to give something to the European Union to make them happy, and to countries like the Netherlands, who were very critical, and countries like the Netherlands realized how critical Poland is in this whole conflict, not just logistically, militarily, diplomatically, in all fronts, right? So what you could see before the full-scale invasion, the Netherlands was one of the harsher critics. Our prime minister was one of the leaders suggesting that Poland should not receive its COVID-19 support, billions of euros from Brussels, because of its undermining of the rule of law. That was cleared up after Poland did some small concessions at the beginning of last year. And now you noticed, even now with the Lex Tusk, of course, and the broader worries there are about these new developments for a commission to investigate Russian influence, you could see that basically we do not dare to speak what we believe to be important for the rule of law, right? So a couple of weeks ago, your Prime Minister Morawiecki visited our Prime Minister in the Netherlands. And basically, you could even say, like, at the, it was just after this this Lex Tusk, as they call it, was announced, that basically our prime minister was still using fluff around it to keep, you know, his Polish counterpart happy. He wouldn't say we disagree or whatever. He was explaining we are of course interested in the worries of, right? So you could really much, very much see, because they were also talking about support for Ukraine, this conflict of, okay, on one hand, we need Poland. Poland needs us. This is the broader debate. At the same time, we are very much not at ease with what's happening, especially in this election year. And we still have to see what's going to happen, right? We still have to see whether it's actually going to be used the coming months to take out political opponents. We very much don't like it, but for now, we're just going to keep, you know, stay friendly, and we hope there's going to be a way out, because yeah, there's, with our support for Ukraine, there's no way around Poland in the most literal way because of its position, but also in a broader sense, of course.
Another topic that is controversial even inside Poland, between the government and the opposition, but well, it seemed that it gained the government, in this case Polish government, gained support from the European Union, even if it was a silent support. I'm talking about the border crisis with Belarus, migration crisis on the border. Now, I know that you've been also investigating this topic.
Yeah, of course. Another important topic where Poland plays such a critical role as a border state for the European Union. What you notice, but that's a broader sense you get in Europe, right? Where we have been desensitized towards like images of cruelty and death along our borders. Obviously, it started as a hybrid form of warfare from Belarus. By now, it's become a natural route. Actually, the people I spoke to along the border, migrants I spoke to, actually travel through Russia now, but they travel on their own initiative. So they weren't flown in by Belarus like a couple years ago, but they're still coming in large amount of numbers. And what you can basically, the sort of silent support, as you stated, I think it there is no clear answer yet from Europe, from countries like the Netherlands, because we don't know what to do differently, and also we do not dare to speak out the harsh truth, also when it comes to the horrible treatment of migrants along the border, you know, mostly on the Belarus side, but there's also, you know, with the fence and everything, people disappearing in the forest, people, the pushbacks, you know, which used to be considered illegal and against international law. Now it's just accepted as a common practice all along the European border. The fact that there is not actual harsh resistance from countries like the Netherlands basically shows that, I guess, there is no clear answer how to do it differently at the moment. I don't know if that answers your question, sort of, but it's what we see both in the Mediterranean Sea and we see it along the border of Belarus. There is no clear alternative presented from other countries, Western European countries. So the easiest thing to do, especially with all the other struggles we have at the moment, is just to, you know, look away for now and, you know, let Poland and Lithuania, of course, solve it by closing up the border as much as they can and pushing back migrants.
You've been in Poland for a few months now. What is the most outstanding thing here? What is the catches the most your attention?
So what I find very fascinating about Poland is, from what I can see, it's there's a huge amount of polarization right now within society, and that's only going to get stronger in the coming months. Obviously, we had a month ago, we had the big march in Warsaw, might be the biggest protest in decades. And what you still notice, it was a clear sign of discontent from a large part of the population about, well, a lot of things that are happening in the country, from rule of law, abortion, but also galvanized by the latest, as they call it, Lex Tusk, right? What I noticed, though, despite hundreds of thousands of people being on the march, it was still somehow in such an orderly fashion, right? I know from plenty of other countries where protests, even the smallest protests, can easily escalate. And what is, for now, kind of, I guess, inspiring, if you consider the actual polarization and how far away both sides in the current Polish society are. They hardly speak to each other anymore. There's a demonization of the other side. Somehow, these kind of protests still go in such an orderly and peaceful fashion, right? I couldn't find any reports of civil unrest or disobedience, despite hundreds of thousands of people at the same time marching through Warsaw. So I guess that's within the larger political spectrum, I would say, a positive note about what we might can maybe expect for the rest of this election year.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Piotr.
This was the Political Periscope. The podcast is released every Thursday at 7 p.m.